Today, we will have three speakers that will be discussing the Western Area Power Administration and Bonneville Power Administration's point of view on transmission planning. We will have a question and answer session after each speaker has finished their portion of the webinar. You can participate by submitting your questions electronically throughout the webinar. Please do this by going to the questions pane in the box showing on your screen. There you can type in any question that you have during the course of the webinar. Our speakers will address as many questions as time allows. Before our speakers begin their presentations, we will have a brief introduction from Lucas Lucero from the Bureau of Land Management. Lucas is the Rights of Way Branch Chief at the Bureau of Land Management. Lucas?
Hello, Courtney. Thank you for the introduction, and thank you for all for joining us on webinar number 3. I'm Lucas Lucero, the Branch Chief for Rights of Way with the BLM Washington office, and I want to thank NREL for working with us to bring this training to BLM staff and managers. We've had training from NREL in the past for wind energy development and solar energy development, and now we're expanding that training to include hydropower and transmission lines. So again, I want to thank each of you for taking the time to join our webinar series. The BLM Washington office recognizes that with declining budgets and travel restrictions, it's difficult for you to get away from your office to attend training. BLM, in cooperation with NREL, developed this webinar series to inform as many managers and staff regarding electric transmission line projects. We held our first two webinars in October and November. This is the third of our series of webinars. We're expecting to have approximately two more. Currently, BLM is faced with over 30 high voltage transmission projects spanning 11 states, affecting approximately 58 field offices. If you refer to the map on your screen. Many of these projects affect other federal agencies, and we've invited them to join us on these webinars. Secretary Salazar and BLM Director have placed a high priority on timely and effective reviews of transmission projects. With an aging electrical infrastructure and continued emphasis on expanded generation from renewables, natural gas, and our transmission workload, it's expected to remain high, so it's important that BLM managers and staff have a solid understanding of high voltage transmission projects. So we hope you'll find this webinar series informative. We are recording these webinars and we will make these available at a later date. Thanks again for joining us, and I'll turn it back over to Courtney with NREL. Thank you.
Thank you, Lucas. Our first speaker today is Bob Easton. Bob is the Manager of Transmission Planning North for the Western Area Power Administration's Rocky Mountain Regional Office. Bob joined Western in 1983 and has held positions in construction inspection, transmission planning, and scheduling and billing. He has a degree in electrical and electronics engineering. With that, we will go ahead and get started with the presentation. Bob?
Afternoon, everybody. Can you hear me okay?
Can hear you just fine, Bob.
Great. Like Courtney said, my footprint basically is for WAPA is Wyoming and Colorado, and you saw from the earlier slide a lot of those higher voltage lines are emanating from Wyoming. I'm going to touch on four items today. I'm going to talk a little bit about kind of our rules making folks, which is FERC and NERC. I'm going to talk about our annual planning process, which you could probably talk about any transmission provider. It kind of goes through the same process on an annual basis. A little history on line separation, and then just give an example of a typical flow gate we have in this area, which is called TOTE 3. That's the TOTE 3 example. This diagram just depicts a typical transmission system from a hydro plant in the upper left. You step up the voltage to a high voltage so you can transport bulk power at lower current across the lattice type structure you see. And then you step it down to a substation with lower voltage, then typically you'll see the wood poles, which is maybe a 115 kV system, step down further to a distribution sub in the lower left, and then out to the individual pole top transformers to your, you know, your homes, churches, and rural entities. A little bit on FERC and NERC. Just some recent rulings that we've been living with. Originally, in 1992, the first big ruling that told transmission owners and generation owners that you're going to separate your your functions. You're going to basically set up a generation company and a transmission company, and also you are going to start posting your transmission availability on a system known as OASIS, which stands for Open Access Same Time Information System. Those were orders 888 and 889. More recently, we had the Energy Policy Act of 2005, which basically gave FERC the authority to manage the ERO, which is NERC, the Electric Reliability Organization, which is NERC, who in turn manages, they manage the regional reliability organizations, known as WEC. I think there's about a dozen in the North American system. And they basically, the NERC folks manage the standards and developing compliance processes to meet the NERC standards. More recently, we had an order 890, which tells folks you have to have a more open stakeholder-involved process for your transmission planning. And then came about the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, which out of that came the TIP project that Kai Ching will talk about in a few minutes. Order 1000 is more recent, which basically builds on Order 890 and tells us we have to have a more inclusive planning process and come up with a cost-benefit analysis and cost allocation on both inter- and intra-regional basis. And I'll show you some diagrams of what I'm talking about with Order 1000. Now, the North American interconnections are basically four. You have the Quebec Interconnect, Eastern Interconnect, Western Interconnect, and Texas. And if you kind of think about it, the electric system developed as the population developed. So population started at the coasts and kind of grew to the middle, and the electric system followed along. And when it got to the middle here, where you see this separation between the east and west, the system is basically pretty weak, and you can't tie the AC systems together just because the systems operate, of course, on 60 hertz on either side, but they're a little bit out of phase, so you can't tie the AC systems together. They're not strong enough. So we built a series of DC ties, of which there are eight now. So what I'm going to focus on is the Western interconnection. And WEC is basically broken down into six sub-regional, as we called them in the past, sub-regional planning groups. And this is just a diagram kind of outlining the footprints of Colorado Coordinated Planning Group, Southwest Area, Northern Tier, Columbia Grid, and the two in Canada. Then the only organized market in the West we had to deal with is the California Independent System Operator. Now these are known as regional, sub-regional groups and regional groups. If you look at the dotted line outlining this West Connect footprint, that's the regional group that is going about coming up with the filings that are required under Order 1000. So you can see within that West Connect footprint, there's these three sub-regional groups have their own governance. It's basically volunteers. There's not really a dues-paying entity. Within West Connect, there is. Now, these folks coordinate information that we all use to study this transmission system, provide a forum to coordinate these 10-year studies, and are the forums to agree on what are the cost-benefit analysis and the cost allocation process that will come out of our Order 1000 processes. NERC planning standards, we all meet these TPL standards they're referred to. Basically, we look at 10-year cases. They have what is termed a near-term window, which is years 1 to 5, far-term window, which is years 6 to 10, and there are different categories of studies we do. Category A, system intact, which is N-0. Category B, N-1s. Category Cs are basically greater than, so you take more than one line out of service. And we analyze against a set of criteria. We look at the bus voltages, if they're within a range, and line flows, if they're within range, through the results of our studies. And now I'll just talk through a typical planning process. This is the one I use. This is the one I adhere to in my region, which again is Wyoming, Colorado footprint. And I do this on an annual basis. Typically, I send out my load forecast request to all my network customers in February, and we just did this in the past week. Request that data to come back to me in 6 weeks. We basically have 3 months to do this study. We pick different years, like I mentioned earlier. We'll pick a near-term case. So bringing it to 2013, we'll pick a base case that's up to 2018, somewhere in that window, and then we'll also pick one between 2018 and 2023. we use different seasonal load patterns and different seasonal generation dispatches just to get a breadth of what the system topology looks like. And we plug in these 10-year forecasts from our customers. We develop a report that looks at where pieces of the system might need reinforcing. We hand that off to our 5640, which is our construction engineering folks, and they come up with a 10-year plan that basically lines out our capital investment we want to try to implement over the next 10 years. In this last study process, which was last year, we looked at, and these acronyms, I'll just explain them. You see that one bubble is 2015 heavy autumn, so we looked at a heavy autumn case, which models the loads relative to autumn time frame, October, basically, in the generation patterns. We used a 2017 heavy summer, and we used a 2022 light summer. So we used those three base cases and simulated the stress on the system, and I'll talk about what these TOPEs are here in a few minutes. And basically, the recommendations we came up with were some improvements in the Bighorn Basin, which is in northern Wyoming. We're seeing some overloading on some 115 kV lines. We need to add some reactive devices in south central Colorado to help with some high voltages we've been seeing. We have some transformers we're seeing are starting to overload just based on historical loading. And then we have to do a more detailed study in the Bighorn Basin to come up with an overall plan. We have a 69 kV system that looks like it needs to be upgraded to 115. One of the things we've added just recently, too, is to look at a capacity adequacy analysis. We have a transmission business unit in our organization that basically looks on where people are asking for transmission on that oasis I mentioned a bit ago and where we're denying requests. That gives us an indication of where we might have a need for additional transmission and where congestion might be occurring. And some of the results of that analysis gave us an idea to look in the Craig Bonanza area, which is basically between northwest Colorado and northeast Utah. Look in central Wyoming, Dave Johnson, toward northern Colorado. That path I'll talk about in a minute. Four Corners area, we're seeing congestion down, trying to get more resource from the north, as I call it, down in the Four Corners area to the load centers in Arizona, and then paths from Arizona toward California. A few slides on line separation. This is a interesting topic. A typical 500 kV tower lattice structure has kind of these dimensions. They're anywhere from 100 to 170 feet tall and about 100 feet across, and they carry three sets of wires in the two outer phases and the one through the window in the middle phase. There are different ideas on how lines should be separated. Typically, what we like to do is keep the lines at least a tower height away from each other. If you look at this diagram, it's kind of a minimalist idea that, you know, if the situation could occur that one tower could collapse and fall into the other, what we try to do is minimize the possibility of that occurring. In reality, these towers won't really fall straight down. They actually are built to crumple. So what we try to do is just build the system and maintain these separations to minimize the possibility of losing multiple structures. We try to build and rate the system based on losing one most severe line or one most severe contingency. There are other ideas that you try to at least separate lines by what we call a span length. And that's the distance between structures. And typically on a 500 kV system, it's about 1,500 feet. And the idea here is that you're trying to protect against, say, like an aircraft coming in contact with the overhead ground wire from one structure and dragging it across to the other structure and losing both lines simultaneously. And basically, I think the message is there's really no one-size-fits-all. From a reliability perspective, we're trying to just minimize the probability of one contingency going into two contingencies. Of course, the further apart you put lines, you have land use and environmental issues. A lot of public involvement and folks wanting to put lines down into a single corridor. And then you have national interests and state and regional folks also. And it's probably different from state to state on the different requirements for siting transmission. Some of the other things to consider Of course, redundancy in lines adds to more stable system. The span length, as I mentioned, cuts down on possibility of one wire being swung into another. We have different requirements, whether we're on a farmlands kind of situation or in mountains where we have possibility of forest fires taking out, you know, separate lines simultaneously. There's a new business practice within WEC that basically states you need to keep a 250-foot separation between structures in order to be considered studying as a level C, which is an N-2 versus a level D, which is what we call it. That's basically you look at loss of multiple lines simultaneously, and you really study that for what the consequences are. You really don't have to study to fix the system when you look at level D, but that's the difference between having this 250-foot, having to study those two lines simultaneously out versus one at a time. Now I'll talk about this tote system we have in the West. Or constrained path is another term you might hear folks use. This diagram coming up is basically just an overview of the major transmission in the West, and you'll see these little numbers in the boxes. Basically, there's a document called our path reading catalog that each one of these sets of lines is documented in, and I'm going to talk about the one over here on the right. It's between Wyoming and Colorado, known as Path 36, or as I call it, TOTE 3, and TOTE, T-O-T, is just short for total. Path 36, or TOTE 3, is made of actually six transmission lines between southeast Wyoming and north-central Colorado. These are some of the different TOTE paths within this area that I manage, basically. TOTE 1A is between Colorado, Utah. 2A, it's rated in the east-to-west direction. 2A from north to south into the Four Corners area. And these arrows are just to indicate the path, the direction they're rated. TOTE 2A does have a south to north. 1A has a west to east. Then TOTE 3 basically is a north to south path. And these are the allocations of the capacity. It's rated at 1,680 megawatts. The Missouri Basin system is the generation at Wheatland, Wyoming, Laramie River Station. It's a 1,500 megawatt coal plant. WAPA, we have 25% of the path. Tri-State and Piesco have 75 megawatts of the capacity. This is just an example of how we try to manage this system. If you take a look at this diagram, the two red lines are 345 kV that emanate from LRS, the generator to the north, and come down to the Front Range and northeast plains of Colorado. And typically this is the flow split. You'll see the 400 megawatts on the story line, 700 megawatts on the alt line. So what we try to protect against is the system has to be able to withstand single most severe contingency, and typically it's this LRS to story line. If that has a fault and goes out of service, that 400 megawatts has to redistribute somewhere, and basically it'll 300 of the megawatts will flow down onto the LRS alt line and load it to its rating. That's the thermal capacity of that wire. It can't go above 1,000 megawatts where you have heating problems, and then as the wire heats up, it sags between the structures, and there are limitations as far as how close that can really get to the ground before you violate NERC and electrical standards. This is just demonstrating that outage redistributes the flow such as that. Now, if we take and we plug a 200 megawatt wind plant, say, into that LRS alt line, the flow has to distribute somehow, so you can see that 700 megawatts went to 850, so 150 megawatts flows straight down toward alt, and 50 of that 200 picked up on the LRS story line. Now, if we have the same contingency, that 450 megawatts has to redistribute, and what happens is it flows back over on this LRS alt line, which is puts it above its rating, which flows to about 1,200 megawatts. So that tells me that I've got a problem. I've gone over my thermal limit of that wire. So being that the last guy on typically has to accommodate these thermal limits, that wind entity would be responsible in some way, shape, or form to increase the rating of my LRS alt line to at least the 1,200 megawatts. And typically what we do is we have to rebuild the wire or put bigger wire on. We don't like to use remedial action, so we don't really allow that, okay, if that line goes out towards Story, we don't say that, okay, it's okay to turn the wind off. We basically want to build the wire to accommodate that, and the cost responsibility would be borne by that entity. Or things like August 14, 2003 can happen, which was the big outage in the east where New York, well, toward New York City went dark. That's all I had for my presentation. I don't know if you want to take questions now, Courtney, or wait till the end.
Looks like we do have a question. Can you explain the new WEC standard of 250 feet? And would the separation requirement be known by the time a company goes to the Bureau of Land Management?
It should be. I don't know where and what step in the process that the company goes to BLM. The way I understand it is typically an investor-owned, let's say, PacifiCorp. They're big in Wyoming. They're trying to build some lines toward the west. They would come to BLM to help define that right-of-way through their environmental process. WAPA, we do the same thing. We would be joint lead agents with BLM, and you would be figuring out that separation distance from existing wire to your new wire during that whole process. The 250 feet is merely that you keep them 250 feet apart at least, and you don't have to study loss of that new line and an existing line simultaneously. So you can basically study and just lose the one line versus the two lines simultaneously. And it's the difference between a level B and a level C meeting the requirements in the NERC standards. And it's a level B, I'm not sure if the word is less stringent. You still have to meet voltage criteria and that thermal loading issue I talked about, like on that TOTE 3 example. But you don't have to, you aren't required to study them simultaneously, losing both of them simultaneously. Now, folks will still do that. You'll end up having to look at a level D, which is loss of a corridor. Not that those consequences of that type of contingency you have to be fixed. Like I talked about, the wind guy being the last one on the system has to fix that loading issue. In the level D analysis, you'll decide, okay, I'm going to put a 500 kV in parallel with a 230. You would look at losing both of those at the same time, but what you're really looking for there is the system going to fall apart? Is the system going to go unstable? And if that's the answer, you vet this through a WEC rating process, and it's determined during that process whether or not the consequences of that type of a level D outage are bad enough for people to have to fix it. So the 250 feet is basically just determines whether you study a single contingency versus an N-2 in your rating process.
Okay, thank you very much for that answer. For our second speaker today, I would like to introduce Kai Chen. Kai Chen is responsible for the transmission system planning aspect of Western Transmission Infrastructure Program, or TIP office. He has over 20 years of experience involving power system planning, analysis, and operation. He joined the TIP office in 2009. Prior to joining Western, he was a supervisor responsible for generation interconnection process for PG&E. So I will go ahead and turn it over to Kai Chen.
Thank you. Bob just covered the traditional way how transmission planning work in utility, no matter it's a private-owned utility or it's a public-owned utility. So in Bob's day-to-day activity, he will actively evaluate the system and trying to find the weakest link within the system and then reinforce the system to improve the reliability or just keep the reliability and support the low forecast. However, in transmission infrastructure program, aka TIP, the transmission planning activity is different than the traditional transmission planning because in TIP, we do not actively looking for weakness link we're just passively accepting application from transmission project developers. So in our transmission planning activity within TIP, most of us are just passively monitoring the progress of project planning activity, how they communicate to the planners community, how they initiate a project, how they coordinate with other utility, other transmission owners, and how that project will coordinate with the existing system to not degrade the stability of the existing system. The TIP program overview were implemented according to Title III Hoover Power Plan Act of 1984 under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. The borrowing authority up to $3.25 billion from Treasury to support the transmission project. Our activity including identifying, prioritize, and participate in the study phase and facilitate financing, planning, operating, maintenance, and construction of new and upgrade transmission facilities. However, this transmission facility is going to deliver renewable resource or is going to deliver some future renewable resource. TIP program is created in 2009. In February 2009, Western received the borrowing authority from Congress and then published a notice available request for interest to all the interested stakeholders. In April 2009, we receive over 200 statements of interest from those potential project developers. I joined the program in June 2009, so almost from starting of the TIP office, I was here responsible for transmission planning activity. And in October 2009, we filled the staff and have the manager to start our operation. Right now, now is 2013. TIP office is transitioning from the startup phase to a permanent phase. We're still open to any solicitation from project developers if they are looking for any support from the TIP office. During this first, now is already 4 years of the development of the TIP office. We're trying to drive the car at the same time we're fixing the car. And in the last year, we have a TIP optimization team try to continuously improve the TIP's workflow, evaluate the program project, the development process, and how to evaluate the existing criteria, how to screenize and prioritize the potential program projects. We also want to increase the transparency to let those potential projects know how we operate, improving the communication with any stakeholders. We have a public website for TIP that will post the development for the optimization process. When I was invited to this webinar, I think probably we will have something from the optimization effort to actually introduce in this webinar, but according to the most recent schedule, I don't think we have anything posted in our public website before the middle of this year. So I will just have to invite all the planning community, if they're interested in the TIP office, they can monitor our website and see our near future's development, how to work with TIP, how to do business with TIP. Even though the optimization effort did not come to deliver some solid criteria yet, but we still have our principle that was developed during the when we have created the TIP office in 2009. Those projects have to meet certain criteria in order to receive TIP's funding authority. Projects must have one terminus within the area served by Western, but need not to connect to a Western-owned facility. So since Western covered the west portion of the United States, any line within this area, at least one terminal within this area, is will meet the criteria for selecting projects. And those transmission projects supposed to deliver or facilitate the delivery of a renewable resource to be constructed reasonably expected to be constructed. And we encouraged a broad-based participation, so we encourage all the developers to expand the outreach program, and we will join them with an open scope meeting. The project revenue will be the only resource for the repayment of the loan, and also payment for all the O&M ancillary service. The cash flow within the project will maintain the control of the accounting and payment. And projects under this authority are separate from and distinct from any other project. So the project have to be financially stand alone to generate its own revenue and paying back the loan. Other criteria is ensure the project beneficiaries repay project costs. They also meet the first order 1,000. How the costs are located. So the beneficiary is supposed to pay back the cost of the project. Must be in the public interest, must not impair the system reliability. That's where I came from, because I'm going to make sure those projects, when they go through the planning process, they will not have a system impact that will degrade the system reliability. We will also check the financial situation of the project, that there should be a reasonable expectation that the repayment of the principal of the interest, that the loan will be, have somehow, will be expected to be paid back after the project in service. The rate is supposed to use a public process to set for the new project, and those must be independently obtained and arranged for delivery or generation-related service. It's something from the previous slide. We summarized that the selection criteria. Project under consideration for the TIP funding must use for facilitate the delivery of renewable generation and have at least one terminal located within Western service territory. Other things such as the financial soundness of the project and have to meet all the OATT or other related requirements. Of course, a project have to go through the feasibility and show its technical merit and financial feasible. Financial stability and capability of a potential project. And we will also look at the project readiness, because as we know that the transmission project usually take a long time, goes through the EIS, goes through the local state permit, and goes through like the WAC pass rating process. How they move along this way to get the necessary permit, to get the necessary approval from the authority, that will how we evaluate the project's readiness. And of course, the project have to be participate in the regional wide interconnection planning group, such as those sub planning group Bob have mentioned in his presentation. So far, the TIP projects have developed into three different business model. The first one, TIP just act as purely financial, just like a bank, lending the money for construction, and then the engineering portion is did not get involved that much. But of course, when the project are looking for other help, especially in EIS or land acquisition, that was Western's strong suit. So TIP will go to the Western team to provide very strong support in that two areas. The second business model is a public-private partnership. Most of our projects fall in this category. We will have the Western will like a partial owner of the project. The percentage could be negotiable and depends on how the project developer looking for a Western. Are they just looking for a minimum ownership by Western, or they will like a 50-50 percent share with the Western? That depends on the project model. One example is the Transpress Express Transmission Project. And then the third business model in TIP is Western's own internal transmission project. Some our region like IMR or our Delta Southwest, they will propose some project that will either going to deliver renewable or they will provide some beneficial to a tribal area, and that all meet our TIP's project selection criteria. In this same slide, the first model, financial model, the example of the Montana Alberta Tire Limited, the metal project, they already closed because after TIP support the project with a very strong support in land acquisition and the environmental impact, and then the project's developer, they think they can complete the project even without Western support. So after the area completed, they pay the whole loan amount, like 161 million back to Treasury. So that's one complete project in TIP's activity. Negotiate with developers. When we select the statement of interest, the first stage is negotiate advance funding agreements between Western and then with the developer. Some money will be provided by the developer, and then a portion will be divided by TIP. Most likely is 50-50. And those money will be put into a common account, and then any activity associated with the project will be taken from that account. TIP bring the following to a transaction. It's like a siting, scoping, it's a environmental support. And then we'll also have the web pass rating expertise to provide support. With the interconnection agreements, like those generation interconnection or transmission interconnection agreements with the facility owner. Western also have a very strong design team. So any transmission line design or substation design, Western is capable to provide a very strong team to work on in that area. And then there's also construction management, quality assurance, so the EPC. For the financial side, even though Western is not actually like a worker as a bank, but we will support the financial structure and how to create a business model. And then since Western is a transmission provider, we do have operational and maintenance capability to support any transmission project. Of course, keeps their own borrowing authority, financially can support the budget, the project to develop until complete in service. And we cover very wide area. We are very experienced with the regulatory style of issues. In this example of our structure, usually a project developer, they will set up a project special purpose vehicle, LLC, to work on their specific project. Like the financial may be under another name, but they create a project, special project name as a company that will only work on that project. And then Western will join in with the project developers vehicle LLC to create an entity to work on the project. And this slide shows how many different area Western TIF can provide support, like the financial agreement. We can support from TIPS borrowing authority or support the project to create a very strong financial backbone to apply for other private lending facility. In the O&M, we can support in EPC and then O&M agreement. If it's a generation developer, we can provide the power purchasing agreement and support. If a transmission developer is the transmission service arrangement for that project. To be able to get the TIF funding, there's an underwriting requirement, a very solid business plan, and the how the project will operate. The financial and commercial sound project produce adequate cash flow to pay all operational costs, service or debt, provide owner a reasonable rate of return. And then we will also check the record of a similar project by the same developer. So usually the statement of interest will include the past experience of the developer. When the project works with Western TIP, the team will develop some documentation for Western administrators to certify. This includes the previously mentioned criteria, like in public interest, did not degrade the existing reliability of the existing system, and reasonable expectation of the payback of all the loans to the TIP funding. The last slide here is some contact information for the Western TIP project. That's conclude my presentation.
Great. Thank you, Kai-Chen. Now, let me see. It looks like we did have a few questions. How does the relatively new TIP entity work or coordinate with existing state government-based transmission bonding project financing authorities, as an example, coordination with Utah's Renewable Energy Electric Network Board, et cetera?
You mean with the existing transmission facility owner, or is the fund regulation, other state regulation? I don't quite follow the question.
Yeah, it doesn't specify. Yeah, it doesn't specify, but we can get back to that person if they clarify.
Can you read it? Can you read it again, Courtney?
Sure. How does the relatively new TIP entity work or coordinate with existing state government-based transmission bonding authorities?
Well, Kai Ching, maybe one example might be how we partnered with the Wyoming Infrastructure Authority several years ago. The TIP office was asked to help coordinate, like you saw that first diagram with the big lines emanating out of Wyoming, and we were asked to get everybody in a room and see if we could do something more efficient. Spent 2 years doing some studies and getting people to see what might work better. That's one benefit, I guess, of the TIP office. They didn't put any money toward that. It was basically the Infrastructure Authority that funded a lot of those studies.
Okay, thank you very much, Bob. We'll go ahead and get on with the webinar, but please continue to ask the questions and we will answer them at the end. So for our last speaker of the day, I would like to introduce Anders Johnson. Anders is an electrical engineer for the Bonneville Power Administration's Long-Term Planning Group. He is familiar with reliability and economic analysis of transmission projects. Anders?
Hi, this is Anders. Can everybody hear me?
You're good to go.
Okay. I was going to give a high-level overview on how the need for new transmission is defined, and also a high-level overview of what the performance requirements are. The electrical transmission system, there are basically two technologies that can be used to transmit power, either alternating current or direct current. And late in the 1800s, there was a battle between Westinghouse and Edison over which was the better technology to use. And for a variety of reasons, alternating current won out for transmitting power. One of the main reasons is that it was easier to transform the voltage and do taps and terminations. And there's a high-level diagram on the right of how the power system works that power is generated at generating plants, transformed up to a high voltage, and then transmitted to demand centers and stepped back down to serve customer loads. And one of the most important characteristics of the power system is that the generation and the load must always be balanced instantaneously. So your supply always has to match your demand. And then if there's any disturbance, the system will respond faster than humans can take corrective action. So that's what really drives a lot of our standards and our requirements. And one of the disadvantages on the AC system, which is used for almost all of our lines, is that we can closely monitor the flows, but it's difficult to precisely control them. It's a little different than a gas pipeline, might be more like a DC line where you can directly control the flows. And there's several drivers for new transmission that are considered in the planning. One of the most basic ones is load growth. If you have more people, larger cities, more industries, they use more power. That can drive the need for new generators, either to serve the peak loads or more recently for renewables to meet state standards on a minimum percentage of renewable energy. We also see that the transmission utilization can change if some of the older, higher cost, or dirtier units retire due to market reasons or because of emissions regulations. And then also if you have an oversupply in one region and then a shortage in another, that's a signal for transmission between the two. The transmission providers typically have an open access transmission tariff, which requires them to provide service to anyone who submits a request. Although if they don't have capacity available, then they would have to go through the planning process and identify what projects would be needed to meet the request. And the next slide here is some additional planning considerations. I think we talked a little earlier in one of the presentations about how the NERC and WEC transmission planning standards play a big role, that these standards are basically deterministic, that the outages are classified into the different categories, and there's performance requirements for each category. And you know, one example is that all the single contingencies you have to survive without losing load. And then there's the certain common mode contingencies where, like, if lines are on a double circuit tower or adjacent, you have to survive as well. And the thought is that those are likely enough, and that the consequence of a large cascading power outage is so severe that it's not acceptable. So those studies are performed using computer simulations of the entire Western Interconnection. It's a power flow program is what the software is called. And basically there's, I think, tens of thousands of different nodes, and then where all the generation loads and transmission lines are modeled together. And those studies typically use a snapshot of a few different hours. So there would be different base cases for the limiting conditions. For example, you might have your winter peak hour, your summer peak hour. You might also simulate an off-peak hour, because that can be the most limiting for some paths. And then those simulations will be screened against a variety of performance criteria to make sure there aren't any thermal overloads or voltage instability or transient instability. And then another type of study is on the integrated resource planning, and that's looking more holistically at ensuring that there's enough generation to meet expected loads in a cost-effective manner. And transmission plays an important role in this, and even though transmission costs might only be about 10 to 20% of the customer's total bill, the availability of transmission can play a big factor on resource development. For example, I think it's common that generators would have difficulty getting financing if they can't demonstrate that they have transmission to get to their ultimate demand. And so there's also some more economic analysis tools or other simulations. One that my group does is a production cost analysis, where it's also a computer simulation of the full WEC, similar to the power flow, although we're looking at how the generators will dispatch based on their fuel costs and how the transmission congestion may be impacted by new changes or new projects. And there is a real cost to consumers of congestion. An extreme example would be that if you had plenty of, you know, low-cost, clean resources like wind and hydro in one region, but they can't get out to another region that's having to run, you know, expensive, dirty oil plants, there's a high cost to electric consumers and even society as a whole from that. So new transmission lines may be proposed to alleviate that congestion. And here's a simple example of how the planning standards would be implemented, that you have a generator that's sending power along two lines to a load center, and the power splits evenly among the two lines. And then if we lose one of the lines instantaneously, or, you know, within a second, all the power is redistributing to the other line, and that other line has to be able to have enough capability to pick up all that power. Or else in a, you know, in a larger system, if the second line overloads, it'll trip out, and then it'll push the power to a third line, and it may trip out, and you could have a cascading blackout like the 2003 outage in the Northeast. So the planning studies are used to establish system operating limits, so that you make sure you don't go above the safe level. And when we find that there isn't enough capacity on the path, first what we typically look at is if it's possible to get more power through the existing lines. Is there a sort of a simple bottleneck that could be fixed? Could we add extra substation equipment? One example would be we have to plan for failures of circuit breakers, which may take out multiple lines. Sometimes we'll get lucky and we may be able to add a circuit breaker and eliminate the worst outage. With the line rating, sometimes it's possible to increase how much power the line can carry by increasing its clearance to ground or replacing the conductor. And sometimes that's, you can do some control actions as well, like we do some generation dropping with remedial action schemes, especially for common mode outages, like if loss of two lines, that it's fairly uncommon. But sometimes we'll find that building a new line might be the only technically feasible option if we've already maximized what we can do with the existing lines. So if a new line would be needed, that could be accomplished sometimes by rebuilding an existing line to a higher voltage or to a double circuit, or else building an existing corridor, building a new line next to existing lines, or even building in a new corridor. And new lines tend to be lumpy, that there's just certain standard voltage increments, so there's sort of standard capacity increases available, so you might not be able to size the new line exactly to meet the present need, so it might be a little larger. And obviously, lines that may perform well in a power flow simulation might not be feasible to build in real life due to land use constraints, or if it's going to have to go through a national park or something like that, that's just not feasible to do. So that's definitely a consideration. Can touch briefly on available transfer capacity. That's another measure of transmission that refers to the subscription. So if different customers have requested all of the available capacity on a path and may be fully subscribed, and then if we wanted to grant additional firm rights to other customers, then additional capacity would be needed. It's important to have capacity all the way from the generation to the load and not just across the monitored elements on a path. And one consideration we run into when considering whether it's feasible to supersize lines or to push more power through a corridor is that we have to plan for the outages of the double circuit and adjacent circuit lines, or for the full loss of a DC line. So you get the too big to fail problem, that you can put enough wire up that it could hold tons of power, but you have to be able to withstand the loss of that line to really be able to use the capacity that's provided. So it's really sort of a case-specific situation where you need to run the technical studies to see how much incremental capacity you really get by going to double circuit versus single circuit. Sometimes you get double the capacity, sometimes you get far less than that. It really just sort of depends on the characteristics of that particular location and the strength of the parallel lines. And I guess some projects that conceptually tend to perform well is if you have a line that can close in an open loop in the system, that can dramatically increase performance. If you have a kind of an open 500 kV loop and there's a short lower voltage line in between that can effectively act like a fuse and overload really easily when you get any outages. So anything you can do to push power onto your lines with more capacity and pull it off of the bottlenecking lines with low capacity can be very effective. And I guess for our system, one thing that we see is that the Northwest tends to be a surplus area in terms of generation, because we have a large installed hydro base, and then we've added thousands of megawatts of wind in the last few years. So especially in the spring and summer, we see a lot of power flowing north to south out of our region toward the Southwest. And in the winter, we see more power flowing east to west across the Cascade Mountains to our big load centers in Seattle and Portland. So we'll plan a system that can meet all of those different seasonal patterns. Any questions?
Thank you, Anders. Okay, let's see what kind of questions that we do have here today. Okay, it looks like this question, Bob, you might be able to answer it. And please, as I mentioned before, you can submit your questions by going to the question pane in the box showing on your screen. So we will get to as many questions as possible, so please keep continuing to give us more questions. Bob, the transmission systems is a spaghetti bowl of lines. Are there thoughts of consolidating, co-locating them into more concise corridors?
That person that asked that question must be from Wyoming, because they're using a quote that the ex-governor used.
Oh.
Yeah, I kind of don't like the reference to spaghetti bowl myself, but yeah, the system developed the way it did based on where generation was sited and where, when we started electrifying the West, where the loads were. And of course, in the West, you've got long radio lines, typically, because you built the resources remote from the load centers, and that's how things developed. And if you think about the strong wind resources are in the Midwest and then in the Wyoming area. If you've ever been to Wyoming, there's not a place you could go in that state without the wind blowing at some time during the day and some portion of the year. Excellent wind resource, but of course there's no load. The load in Wyoming is small, so their only way to get more resource and capacity to the load centers is to build some transmission. So something would have to be done. Now, siting them in the same corridor, like Anders pointed out, is you do end up having to look at loss of, say, let's say a 3,000 megawatt DC line gets built and it parallels a 2,400 megawatt DC line in Utah. The studies will end up having to look at loss of that 5,400 megawatts at one time, just to see what happens in the system. And if the system holds together, then people will maybe have a inkling that that's maybe okay. If the system shows from the mathematical models that the system falls apart and cascades, and you have outages like we had last, I guess it was a year and a half ago in San Diego, and the one I referred to earlier and Anders did, like in 2003 in the East, there's going to be some pushback on one of two things: either building the line or putting it in that right away, or do you separate it a little bit further so the probabilities of losing them simultaneously is lessened. So I guess that's how I'd answer the question. But squeezing them all down into the same corridor, it just depends. Is it all 230 kV? Is the corridor, you know, transmitting 1,000 megawatts, or is the corridor transmitting 6,000 megawatts? Big difference.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it. Okay. Looks like we answered most of the questions earlier today, but I'll give it a few more minutes just in case you have a question for them, for the speakers. Just give it just a quick minute. And it looks at this time that no other questions are coming in. So I would encourage you, if you do have questions, please go ahead and keep submitting them, and we will get to them even after the webinar is, here we go. I do have a question on if the presentation slides will be available. They will be available at a later date, and we will inform you of when they have been posted and where they've been posted. So we will provide that information at a later time. So I guess at this moment, we will go ahead and wrap up. We would like to thank the Bureau of Land Management, Lucas Lucero, Bob Easton and Kai Chen from the Western Area Power Administration, and Anders Johnson from the Bonneville Power Administration for their time today. Like I mentioned before, the presentation files will be available at a later date. And if you have further questions regarding these webinars, please feel free to contact the Bureau of Land Management, and you can contact anyone on this slide that's showing on your screen right now. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for participating, and goodbye.